This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network, to over 70 community stations around the nation. This is Word for Word, coming to you from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy.
Welcome family and friends, fans and fiends to the 8th edition of Word for Word. I want to thank you for tuning in today. I'm Benjamin Norris and this is a 16-week series where we're getting to know Australia's LGBTI influencers. Each week we will sit down with those who have inspired us, entertained us, but mostly they've made an impact on the queer community. Today's guest is a Melbourne-born and based artist of Aboriginal heritage from the Noongar and Kaurna nations of South Australia. He completed his studies at the Victorian College of the Arts, VCA. He has created a name for himself as a dancer, a choreographer and a puppeteer. He is the creative director at Yurrumboy Festival. This man has a 20-year history working in cultural maintenance, research and revival of the traditional dance with elders and youth from urban to remote Indigenous communities right across Australia. Above all, his unique vision inspires people to discuss cultural difference and provokes our emotion through the arts. I would like to welcome today's guest and welcome to Jacob Boehm.
For me, as a theatre maker, telling traditional stories is that we need to start collaborating with modern art forms so that we can tell our stories in a contemporary manner so that we make them relevant.
Growing up in Australia, you've had some amazing stories which I think have a blend of very familiar stories to some and then some unique learnings as you were getting older. What were you like as a kid?
Okay, so my mother and father, they separated when I was about 4 or 5. So then I had to not only accept that, but soon after my mother and my stepfather got together, and with my stepfather, Terry, he brought 4 children. So by the time I was about 5 and a half, I was navigating that whole blended family thing. So when in my mother and father's children, I was the eldest, but in a blended family I became the middle child.
Does that mean you have a complex understanding of what it's like to be the eldest and the middle child?
Possibly. Possibly.
So hang on a sec, let's talk about how many siblings you've got. So It's a blended family, so there's a lot of them. So how many kids are there in your family?
4 sisters and 2 brothers.
Wow.
Okay. So I'm smack bang in the middle. 2 sisters, an elder. 2 sisters and a brother elder than me, and 2 sisters and a brother younger than me.
And then when the dynamics changed and sort of the family expanded, were you still getting the same sort of attention that you used to get from your mum, or did you feel like it was divided?
I think Mum and Terry did as best they could in trying to blend 2 families and 7 children, and we're all very, very different. And the one thing that we all have is very strong personalities and opinions. So I think they did very well trying to navigate how to cater to each child at a particular age for a particular time, etc., etc.
Where did you fit into the dynamics of your family? Like, was there a role that you seemed to play?
Probably big mouth. So I was always the kid that actually had to go up, regardless of whether I had an older or a younger sibling. I was always the kid that asked Mum and Terry if we could have something.
They sent you along.
Yes, because, I liked an argument. I liked to argue. And I had a problem. That's the one thing I would say as a child. I had a problem with the word no. It was like, but why? Mm-hmm. Explain to me why.
And were they always giving you an answer?
They had to, because I was one of those kids that was always very, I don't know if it was whether belligerent is the right word, or insistent, because I was just kind of had that whole thing, even as a child, about kind of adult authority and power politics. I never understood why I should just accept someone's word for it because they were older than me. I was always kind of pushing the boundaries. Yeah. And I imagine, according to my mother, I pushed a lot of people's buttons as a student, as a young student.
But I think in some ways, I think, you know, obviously you've gone into the creative part of, or you've gone into a creative industry, and I think that's a fairly common trait to have, is to not exactly, you know, draw with the same colour, you know, ask questions and provoke something from deep inside other people.
Yeah.
And I think all of those elements seem to have been formed, you know, through your childhood.
Mm.
How would you identify yourself? Would you identify yourself as a gay man now?
Yes.
So when you worked out your sexuality, do you think that your personality shifted from who you were as a child to then being different once you worked out your sexuality?
Look, I think I'd figured out my sexuality at quite a young age.
How old?
I would say I knew that I liked boys probably by the time I was in kindergarten.
Really?
Yes, and I remember because we had, you know, that silly song that they make kids do, that a farmer picks a wife, a farmer picks a wife, hi oh the derry oh, a farmer picks a wife, and then the wife picks a cow and the cow picks a blah blah. And so each child would, you'd like that ring a ring a rosy. There was one boy that had done the farmer picks a wife, and he chose me to be the wife. And all, I remember distinctly that all the kindergarten carers or teachers went, oh, no, that's not how it's done. You have to pick a girl. And he insisted on picking me. And so they allowed that. So we ran around the circle as the farmer and the wife, and then I had to choose a cow. But I remember even then feeling quite pleased that he had chosen me as his wife.
It was like a warmth. Because, I mean, obviously sexuality is not sort of, it's not a part of our makeup at that stage of our life.
Mm-mm.
So it was more just a deeper connection to someone.
Yeah, but I'd always, okay, so there's a few things. Throughout primary school, I'd always been picked on for being camp. Prior to that, there's probably an event that shaped a few things that bled into my adult life. So my mother distinctly recalls that when ABBA was on television winning Eurovision for Waterloo, I was only about 1 year old, I think. She said I just bolted up, stood up in front of the telly in my nappy and just went crazy. And I discovered a fascination for Agnetta. So it was soon after that my grandparents took me into a shop and I screamed Blue Murder until they bought me a Barbie. And that's, as a one-year-old, that's what I was associating it with. But my mother and my father particularly wondered whether this was, you know, some kind of gay streak or, you know, surfacing in the child. Mm. So I ended up with this huge collection of Barbie dolls, which used to hang from my bedroom ceiling in a big basket. My father, however, at about the age of 3.5, he was back on a drinking spree, and in one of his drinking sprees ripped the basket full of all my precious Barbies and then took them out in the backyard and burned them in front of me. And my mother says at that point, I went from this happy child to a child that was quite a bit more sullen, a bit more dark.
Have you had that conversation with him now about what that meant?
No, I never got a chance to clear that up. My father passed away about 5 years ago. And at that point, when I saw him in the hospital, he'd suffered maybe, it was 2 strokes and a heart attack within the space of a couple of days. And I'd driven my aunties overnight, because the surgeon called and said, if you wanted to see your father, now would be the time. So I drove his 2 older sisters back to Adelaide overnight. And when I got there to the hospital room, I saw this man on the bed. Because most of our adult relationship, after we reconnected, was that kind of that really struggling to connect, and him blaming me for not being around for him and me blaming him right back for leaving us. You know, there was all of that stuff to get through. And that kind of carried on all through my adult life. But when I saw him in the bed that morning, I realised he was the shell of the man that I knew. And he'd had this really, he looked so scared. And I went up to the bed and he had enough strength, because he couldn't speak. He'd lost all, you know, control and da-da-da-da-da. But he had enough strength to grab my hand, like to grab my hand. And as he grabbed my hand and I looked at him, everything that I'd held, like for all those years, just instantly went away. It was just this real relief. It was like I'm never going to get the answers that I thought I wanted, because he's never going to be in a place where he can give me those answers again. And it was magic, because it all just left. And then he continued to live for 7 more years after that, and that was the best 7 years with my dad that I had.
I'm sorry, I'm an emotional person, so while you're telling that story, I'm just doing my best to not be emotional. But I guess it comes back to that original question of, you know, they allowed you to have these Barbies, so something inside of him was like, thought, oh, I'm going to let my son have what he wants.
Mm.
And then to sort of take it away, I think obviously was his own journey.
It was his own, you know, because we didn't see each other really from the time that I was 5 until the time that I was 14. There was a big gap. We were only in contact via the phone for a lot of the time. But from the time I was 14, see, he never had, actually no one, not my mother, not my stepfather, not my biological father, never had an issue with my sexuality. It was only me.
Some of the best conversations I've had about sexuality have been the inner fear that we had, you know, about what we were afraid other people would find out.
Mm.
But once they found out, they then felt as though the pressures were mainly coming from within. Being honest with people, I think, is a huge tool. Mm. And I think when you get to be honest with people about your sexuality, you realise that people don't respond the way you thought they would.
No, and it was a real letdown, actually. It was quite, because I'd built myself up to come out to my mother. I came out to my mother when I was about 12, and I'd
really?
Built it up. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Wow. Yeah. Oh, I bolted out of the gates. I knew what I wanted. Yeah, and I'd built myself up for weeks trying to find the courage to sit down with my mother and go, oh, by the way. And it was such a painful struggle to get the words out of my throat and into my mouth and out of my mouth. And her response was, yeah, I've been waiting for you to tell me this since you were 4.
Yeah, right.
What cultural differences did you have compared to the other kids at school?
I imagine the only cultural differences that we had growing up is that myself, my brother, particularly myself, I continued speaking Noongar in the house. You know, not full sentences, but all the kind of lingo that I'd learnt as a child. So to go to the toilet, we'd say go gunwadli or have a kumba, have a guna. All the Noongar that I'd picked up as a child continued in the house, which everyone else started to speak. So we spoke that at home. The one big difference was because I, as the eldest, I don't know why, but I looked very much like my mother. And as Luke and Kelly, as each child came out, we kind of got darker.
Okay.
So one big thing I do remember as a child is walking my sister home, and for a while there she would be in tears because she would always get picked on and be called names because she looked more Aboriginal than Luke or myself. Mm. So she would get targeted with racist name-calling.
What emotion do you have when it comes to being the older brother and being protective of your sister, but then exploring those racial differences?
Well, that's where the big question marks around identity, other than aside from sexuality, started to play and started to really be internalised and questioned.
Because you're hitting all the minorities. You know?
Yeah, 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 I know. Yeah, because at that age I couldn't understand why she was being targeted and Luke and I weren't. Like, that didn't make sense to me. And then, so then as a child, you had to figure out, so does that mean I am or I'm not? Because we looked so different, like Luke and Kelly are more similar in physical appearance. So all through our childhood, we would say to our mother, like I would say to my mother, I'm adopted, aren't I? Because I didn't look like Luke and Kelly. And Luke and Kelly would secretly ask mum whether they were adopted because they were darker skinned. Mm. So it was this crazy search, I think, from all three of us of how do we fit in, where do we fit in?
When you look back at your childhood, what advice would you give to Jacob as a 12-year-old about those prejudices that you encountered?
Oh, God. Like, this is the thing that we don't talk about much, and I think it's a conversation that a lot of us will probably end up, that you'll probably end up hearing more about. And I think it's something that we should talk more about, is that those of us that identify as Aboriginal, have been brought up as Aboriginal people, that are fair-skinned, are sometimes secretly and shamefully, but very aware of our privilege. Because I pass as a white boy, and I know exactly what my privilege is compared to my sister who was darker and got teased. I know exactly what my privilege is in this world compared to the opportunities that my father was denied because he was a dark-skinned man. I know exactly what my privilege is walking around with this colour skin.
Do you feel like that's sort of a part of where your work goes now, is that you're trying to explore those themes and get people to understand cultural acceptance?
In a nutshell, yes. because we have such a diversity of experience. Like, you know, I mean, I heard something the other day which is a really good example or analogy of what we're dealing with in this country. Mm-hmm. So if you look at the wider map of Europe and you look at France, which is butted up against Spain, which is over the water from the UK, which is then over near Germany. Mm-hmm. If you look at the wider map of, or the map of wider Europe, and you look at the differences in languages, cultural expression, mm-hmm. all butted up next to each other, most countries, you know, smaller than the size of Tasmania, and you look at that and you look at, like, there's about 50 countries, 50-something or more countries that are represented in that map of wider Europe. And look how diverse those cultural expressions and languages are. And that map of wider Europe is probably, when you put that all together, could make up a similar size to the landmass of Australia. Now, here we have 350. So that's what you're dealing with. There's 350 language groups that have specific languages, cultural beliefs and values, cultural practices, songs, dance, song lines, ceremonies, relationship to country, because we go from down here, which is cold, all the way up to the north where it's rainforest, to the middle of the country where it's desert. Mm. You come into 2018, and then someone like myself is here and is speaking about being a member of a family that has three different shades in its siblings, a white mother, a black father. All of us have very different, diverse experiences. There is no one Aboriginal experience.
Certainly not. You know? And I think, you know, I have to be so frank when I say this, because I often fear having conversations with people that I know are Indigenous, because I'm so afraid I'm going to say the wrong thing.
We need to fix that. Why do you feel like you're going to say the wrong thing?
I feel like that there's certain languages or certain understandings that I should have, and maybe it's my ignorance, but I feel like I never want to upset them, and I am wanting to explore that. Like, I want to explore your background. I want to explore the cultural differences. I want to understand them. And I think...
Well, where do you live? Where's your base?
I live in Melbourne.
You live in Melbourne. Yeah. So which suburb? Whereabouts?
Well, I grew up in Templestowe, but I live in Toorak, so...
So you live in Toorak. Do you know what country you live on? What language group? What nation that is?
I have no idea.
See, there's one. So it's Bunmurang.
Okay.
Bunmurang. So you're living and working, or living, I don't know where you work around, but in Toorak, in that side of the bay there, you've got Bunmurang country, and there are probably, I think there are about four or five different clan groups within that language group. So the country that you're in is Yalakat Willem. So even that, just knowing that, rather than finding out what my experience is, I think one of the ways to bridge that gap is to actually go, well, what country am I on? What country do I live on? What country do I work on? Where was I born? Because that's how you place yourself. And that's how you place yourself in country. And that country has stories, and those stories are a lineage that that spans 1,000 generations. And now all the new Australians that live here, just by planting their feet on this country, have a responsibility for that are connected to that and have a responsibility for that 70,000-year-old story and lineage.
I think that's where the fear comes from, because I really should... I fear that not knowing that sort of stuff already makes me seem stupid, and that's my thing, that I don't want to seem stupid, but at the same time, that means I don't explore those things. Like, I don't go, oh, I'm going to now ask those questions, because I'm worried that by my ignorance that I will offend you.
I mean, it's the same kind of... I mean, I suppose it's the same conversation where we could have now in terms of, you know, the work, the wonderful work and acceptance that's being done in terms of, you know, having so many non-binary gender pronouns and the confusion for some of us around, well, what do I ask? Do I ask what your pronoun is? Do I call you by your name? All of that, I kind of relate it back to that and go, well, if I don't ask, I'm not going to know. And if I don't know, then my big mouth is probably going to put me into hot water and then I'll offend someone. I think it's the same thing.
The last thing I was going to say, just a little bit more about your childhood, though, was what does your mum think now of your sexuality?
Oh, it's my business. She's just happy that I've settled down with a partner. She's, you know, because I had been single for many, many, many years. She's just happy that I've got someone that I love and who loves me. I think that's more important than whether Stephen is male or female or in between.
Well, that's what most mums want.
Yeah, you know, that's all.
They're like, they want you to be loved and for you to love someone and to have that relationship, because that's the key to life, really.
Exactly.
Well, I mean, that could be my take on it.
Yeah, no, I think she's actually more relieved that someone else has got to deal with me.
They're like, yeah, so she's less of a stress. You know, do you feel like your sexuality held you back in any way?
Oh, God, no. Like I said, I bolted out of the gates. And I bolted out of the gates, particularly sexually, quite young as well. So I was having sexual experiences with older men from the age of 13. And because I was a big shot know-it-all, I think I, you know, like I thought I was big shot know-it-all, I was, I think that behaviour and the experiences that I put myself into exploring sex and sexuality, that caused a problem. My sexuality, or dealing with my sexuality, didn't stop me from anything. Because I've always been I'm going to go get what I want and get it now and
but
Sagittarian.
Where were you finding that sex? Like, you know, at that age and then, you know, up into being like 16, I guess. Where were you finding the sex?
Oh, God, this is really pervy. It's so weird. There used to be, and I don't know if anybody else remembers this in Melbourne, but when you picked up the phone to make a phone call, in the dial tone, you could hear people talking. And it was it was before all this kind of chat line. You could hear people calling out over the dial tone, and it was particularly around that area, Newport, Altona, Williamstown. And so people would hook up over the dial tone and hand out their numbers so that then you could ring their home line, and then that's how it would happen. And that is how, because when I picked up the dial tone, you would hear these people talking over it, and I was like, what's that?
Get out.
No, true story.
I have never heard that before in my life.
Yep.
And so you were, what, like 13, listening mm-hmm. to dial tone and then giving your phone number out?
Yes.
And then meeting up with these men?
Yes, because it was local.
Wow. And what do you think of that now? Do you think, well, I was exploring my sexuality, that's what I was...
Oh, I'm completely aware that that was risky behaviour. But at that age, you know, like all growing boys, I was ready, you know. But then... from there, probably up until my late teens to early 20s, I had put myself in that many kind of risky behaviours, and mostly all with older men, that's when I developed well, through that I developed issues which I had to then carry through my 20s and try and figure out by my early to mid 30s. That's a whole other yarn.
Yeah, it's all there. I mean, it's an interesting way of looking back. When you look back at, you know, what you did and what you explored through or what you were looking at, and I think at that younger age, they're just hookups. You know, and so then you're sort of looking for hookups and there's no relationship that backs that. When was the first time you fell in love with somebody then continued into sex?
I met a boy. I had my first crush, my first real boyfriend at...
Drum roll.
16. Yes, his name was Charles. He was a spunk.
When did you meet him?
Well, there used to be a group here in Melbourne. I mean, there's still groups that act like that now. I can't remember the name of it, but it was a group for under 18s and used to meet there. So I met Charles in that kind of social group. Mm-hmm. And then all of us, even us underagers, ended up at the Peel.
Wow.
And, oh, God, no, I went to my first club when I was 14. I was at 397 down Swanson Street and jumping the back of the Peel but at that age too, because that's how all us underagers used to get in, jump the back fence.
Yeah.
When they used to have a back fence.
What drew you at that age to want to go and explore the arts?
I ended up at VCA later. So first I went to NASDA. So I ended up doing a Bachelor in Nothing at Melbourne Uni.
Very common.
And it was Annie Carolyn Briggs who headed up the Currie student unit at that time. I was about 20, 21. And she pulled me into her office and she said, "How are you going here, bub?" And I went, And she went, "You don't like it, do you?" I went, "Not really." And she went, "Have you ever heard of NASDA?" And I went, "No, what's that?" And she went, "It's an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander dance theatre. It's a school where you can learn ballet, tap, jazz, contemporary and Aboriginal dancing, like cultural dance."
And you'd never been taught any of that before?
Mm-mm.
So this is your first...
This was my first foray into dance. Mm-hmm. And because I'd always thought that I'd missed the boat. By the time I was a teenager, I thought any kind of dance training you had to do, you had to be one of those, you had to be in your 2x4. You know what I mean? So I thought I'd missed the boat. I know.
You've got to live by that mantra.
Exactly. And so this school catered for mob, particularly who were over 18, who hadn't had dance training before. So within a couple of months, I'd filled out, you know, by that end of that meeting, I'd filled out a form, we'd faxed it off because there was faxes then, and then I was booked in to go up to Sydney and audition, and by the end of, within a couple of months, I'd started my dance training.
Wow.
So I did dance before I went to VCA.
Was there a genuine emotion inside of you, like an awakening?
Mm-hmm. God, yeah. Like a lot of us, like NASDA was really good for bringing a lot of us together from all us young kids, for whatever reason, from all over the country in the Torres Strait, all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander young'uns. Again, very different experiences from very different country. But most of us with the similar experience of not having been brought up with our cultural dance or song. You know, like my father and our family come from the mission at Point Pierce on Noongar country where that was banned. So, and a lot of us come from those families. So what ended up happening at NASDA is you had all of us gathered there, not really, I don't know that it was necessarily about the dance first and foremost. It was about all of us seeking our place, our belonging and our identity. And that's what NASDA was really good for, because we would have song men and women and law men and women teach us particular song cycles over a period of 2 years, and then the mob would change over, the relationship would change with another part of Australia and another part of Torres Strait. And the first year that I was at NASDA, we were taught a creation song cycle from the Tiwi Islands above Darwin. And part of that learning was the elders would come down to Sydney and teach us, and then we would end up, by the end of the year, having to fly up to that country and perform that song cycle for that community, which was nerve-wracking. But I still have this memory distinctly, and I can I'm seeing it right now. For that song cycle, we had to spend hours laying down in this huge hall, and we had all these women and men coming to do paint up, because Tiwi paint up is very intricate. Your entire body is painted with really fine cross thatching, and they were singing and people were laughing and eating and da 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 da, but you had to lie there still for hours until the painting was done. And I remember, because we had to be all shoved, you know, bundled up into the back of a troopy and driven out to this particular tree where the ceremony, where the dance ground was. And I remember as all, like, because when you're lying there for that long and you've got singing happening over the top of you and conversation happening and laughing, you end up going into this other state. It's almost like a meditation. Mm. And I remember as we stepped up into the troopy to be driven off to that tree, it was like, the only way I can explain it was like the night sky had been put in front of me as curtains, and I'd parted the curtains and I'd walked into the night sky and I'd left my body. I no longer existed. Jacob, that individual, that ego, that was that physical attachment, no longer existed, and I was part of a bigger universe as I danced.
Spiritually, that is amazing.
You know? Mm.
Is that a part of a lot of Indigenous people's story? I mean, is that something that happens?
I don't know. I think a lot of us dancers would potentially say the same thing or have that same connection. Mm. I can only speak for myself. And yeah, but ever since I've had that experience, that's what I try and hit now.
What I like about you, and I think I've sort of tapped in on this a few times, is that I think I like the fact that you've gathered all of who you are, all of your truths, and put them together to make it accessible to other people. And, you know, you've really been blending or bringing modern art with traditional stories, you know, and I felt like that's been seen. And, you know, even doing puppetry and tapping into those themes or drawing from those themes of your Indigenous background as well. It's almost like it's spewed out this version of yourself. I mean, that's a kind of, it's a silly way for saying it, but it's at the same time, that feels very truthful of who you are,
like,
to tap into all those things. I mean, I did see somewhere that you said, you know, you want people to understand more things about Indigenous people by blending modern art with, you know, what it was like beforehand.
With our cultural dramaturgies and methodologies, yes.
Can you talk a little bit about that? Because that, to me, is really interesting. What was the design? Because I think for a lot of people, they could go, oh, well, I'm an Indigenous person, so I'm going to represent just the cultural. I mean, I'm going to be very strict with the foundation of that, and I don't want to deter it. But for you, you've really blended that.
Trying to. And my recent work, Blood on the Dance Floor, which we did at Arts House in 2016 and then at Sydney Fest last year, that was a real coming together of all the experiences I've had so far. Well, the challenge for us when we were making Blood on the Dance Floor was to remove Western dramaturgy from the process and preference Indigenous cultural dramaturgies and methodologies in how we made a piece of contemporary dance theatre. Stupid question, really. Like, just totally ridiculous to put ourselves through it, but important.
Yeah, have you ever had ancestral people say that they don't appreciate your work? Have you ever had that?
No.
Where people go, oh, there's some licensing being borrowed from different cultural stories and then being interpreted in your own manner.
Never to myself personally. I know that there's a camp, you know, as with every community, there are always going to be camps and opinions, and you're going to fall into either one or whatever one there is. And there are you know, people, like I, yeah, so for 20 years, like you said in the intro, I've been working with communities around Australia in cultural maintenance and revival of traditional dance. And those have been through projects that, you know, are built between elders and youth. Contemporary art forms are generally the main focus as you go in, because that's what's going to catch the kids, with the understanding that the elders are going to be bringing in traditional knowledge, and that will really influence what the end result may be. Because in effect, what you're doing is trying to trick them into coming in and making a hip-hop dance, but then all of a sudden they make a hip-hop dance and start lyrics, but lyrics they end up getting from song man or woman. You know what I mean? So you're continuing the culture. And this is, I've had the fortune of working with a lot of song men and women who realize exactly where we're at and what's at stake. But this has been part of our culture. That's how we've stayed around for 70,000 years and survived two ice ages from being able to adapt and being smart and ingenious and evolving. That's the only way our culture has lasted for 70,000 years and is the oldest living culture in the world.
Because you're adaptive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's necessarily just me. There's a lot of us that are trying to work in that way. Some elders, I remember, in some communities have been disapproving, but not to me personally, just disapproving of what we're having to do now in some communities to keep language and song alive by infusing it with contemporary art forms.
I remember when I was younger, there was some of these books that I was read, my mother read to me when I was younger, and they were books called, don't want to get them wrong, How the Birds Got Their Colours, The Echidna and the Shade Tree, When the Snake Bites the Sun, Dunby the Owl, all of those books. Like, I have them still at home. But I mean, all of that to me is so fascinating as a child, you know, like, and I think without having any preconceived ideas on race or religion or difference of an opinion, I think, you know, children should be given all stories and be told all elements. And I think that's what changes, or that's what provokes change, is to allow kids to be able to hear different stories from different backgrounds and take what they want from them. You know, and I think that's somehow what you do as well, and you've learnt to do by going out and working with young people, is incorporating your themes and your stories and allowing them to take what they want from it. Is that...
Yeah, and infusing and kind of... and being able to introduce their own personal interpretation on that as well.
What do you reckon are some of the biggest misunderstandings about Indigenous culture when it comes to art?
Oh... Where do we start? That, like I said, that we're all, it's all just a monoculture, that we're all the same, that we all sing the same song and have the same story and God, that we all paint in dots, that didgeridoo is a nationwide instrument.
So I guess the biggest misconception there is just that people believe that they have an idea of what they think Aboriginal people are like, and they don't actually understand that it's very diverse within it.
That we have university degrees and bank accounts and pay mortgages and go on holidays once, twice a year, and...
Sometimes you need to draw it out by talking about it, though. I think that's...
Yeah, but I think the conversation has been around enough now that, you know, when you see those stupid... stupid posts of kids in blackface at college, and that's just blatantly blatantly rude and racist. But then you look at things like, what did Chanel recently do? Was it last year? Was it the Chanel line that created a gold-plated boomerang and charged about $3,000? So you could have a gold-plated Chanel boomerang as a trinket to put on your wall. I mean, as a cultural appropriation, without any contact or relationship with mob, and it's not even that. I mean, there's no acknowledgement of where that design comes from, what that object is, how long it's been around. It then becomes just a commodity for somebody else to use for their own benefit. Mm. That's when it becomes an issue, or it is an issue.
Sort of stepping away from that, though, and looking back at who you are and about your work and your career, getting into being the creative director at Yirrumboy Festival, how did that come into place?
Well, 2 years ago, or two and a bit years ago, the City of Melbourne put out a call for a creative director. It was an Indigenous-identified position. I'd applied, and I was successful. So when I stepped into the role, it was stepping into taking on a festival that had been called the Melbourne Indigenous Arts Festival. It had happened twice before, in 2012 and 2014. And it was a council initiative, but it was running like a consortium model, which, you know, as I looked at it and understood it more, I went, oh, okay, that's how that rolled. No, we need to do it this way now. It needs to be Indigenous-led. It needs to have elders at the core of our business, cultural values at the core of our business, and an opportunity for contemporary Indigenous arts expression to be showcased and celebrated. And not only just from, and for us to use our cultural values as being really good hosts. So remember when, you know, Cook and all them mob came, there weren't frontier wars for about 20 years because our mob, our ancestors, welcomed visitors. And there was a good 20 or so years of peace, of peaceful cohabitation, until the orders came from the empire, take it. There was actually a welcome. And so as a people, we're very generous. And so that's how we looked at it. Okay, this is the country that the festival is going to be held on. What do? We open our arms to visitors. So we included all of our First Nations brothers and sisters from around the world. And yeah, we did. We produced something I think we're all very proud of. I know that the City of Melbourne holds Yirrumboy very dear. They're very proud of Yirrumboy. I'm really proud of Yirrumboy and the community and artists and audiences around it.
And personally, what do you reckon you brought to that festival? The word on the street is you're very good at what you do. And what you've brought to the table has been impressive.
Mm.
But do you know what that is?
I'm not really good at blowing my own trumpet with my work, but
it's interesting though, like, as in, it doesn't necessarily need to be blowing your own trumpet to have a deeper understanding of the quality of work that you bring into something.
Well, number one, Indigenous leadership had to be, the festival had to be guided by Indigenous leaders and cultural values, and those cultural values had to trickle down into every part of business, which is a bit of a weird thing when you're working within this current paradigm, economic structures and da 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 da. But this is when that becomes the real challenge to be bold, to be brave in being more generous, more kind, to work with hope, because to be hopeful requires strategy, and to have strategy means you can see different pathways. Yeah, I think that's what it was. It was always to be reminded that of kindness, of generosity, and of hope. All those three things require of you to do and to stand in your truth.
It's funny, that's what a lot of people are talking about at the moment, is just standing in your truth, telling your own story. The best thing that you have access to is your own journey, your own story, and to share that.
Well, you know, we all have it. It's nothing magical. We've all got it. We're just, you know, the beneficiaries of a very long lineage of people. So we're a link in a chain, and that's kind of what we need to be doing, is to fight and win and lose and make sure that the next link in the chain has it a little easier than we did.
What's the next fight for you in working in the Melbourne arts? Like, what's something that you need to tackle?
We are going to, you know, lots of different work from all over the world. First Nations, some really interesting work from First Nations mob here and living and working in Melbourne and of this country, as well as a whole bunch of mob from all over the world.
Obviously, there's different levels of satisfaction in what you can achieve when you perform personally versus what you teach others. What do you enjoy doing most? Do you enjoy performing or the teaching of others?
I'm getting to that age or stage, I think. I'm not sure. I actually prefer teaching and to be on the other side of it, the creating and collaborating and creating space for other people to
express themselves.
Yes, yes. I much prefer that.
Yeah, I think it's a good space to get into. I think, you know, when we're younger, we're like, you know, we have a bigger burning desire to express ourselves emotionally in a way. And when you're creative, you want to do it. But then sometimes as you get older, it's less about that expression because you've kind of worked it out for yourself. It's more about how you can help other people achieve what you've already done.
Yeah, and I mean, like, I haven't, you know, you know, when you look at it, yes, I have done a lot. Nothing that's, you know, worldwide kind of acknowledgement or acclaim, and that, but that doesn't really bother me. But I don't know, you get to a point where you work and work and work. See, the thing for me is by the time you get to the end of a work and you know what you're doing and it's ready to go up on stage and it goes up on stage and then the applause happens, it's almost like it's a bit of a letdown. It's like, because you never actually get, it never stops. You never actually get the excellence or the thing you think you set yourself to get.
I'm here to say to you that your acclaim and your acknowledgement has been that people know who you are. You know, maybe Nicole Kibben wins an Academy Award, so that's a thing. Or maybe you win the Nobel Peace Prize, or your book goes to number one. I mean, there's different levels of being able to acknowledge or be acknowledged for your work.
I don't know, I think every artist has it. It's kind of depressing in a way, because you never are satisfied.
When I was looking at different people, I classify you as an LGBTI influencer of Australia based on the person that you are and what you've achieved. And they're the things that I liked about who you are. It's like you're going around, you've thought of something, you've taught something to yourself, you've practiced it, you've danced it, you've choreographed it, you've puppeteered it. And then you've also then gone to find other people's truth through art.
Yeah, no. When I landed into this job, what looks on paper like a really ad hoc career all kind of
came together
and went, aha, you're supposed to be, you did all that and you have been leading to this right now.
We've been, I guess, on a real journey with our sexuality, I think, you know, with queer people. You know, what do you think of that journey? Like, where do you think we've been?
Hell. I have to admit, early to mid 2016, I actually got really vulnerable. I have to admit, I felt really raw. I wasn't liking where this was going. I could not stand the posters that were appearing in Melbourne. I could not accept the conversation that was on Facebook, that was on the news, that was in the paper, that was everywhere. It kept bringing up all those childhood memories of being teased. And I felt really unsafe and really vulnerable. And I hated this country because at the time, being a 42-year-old man, I was, how dare you make me feel like this right now when I'm feeling really good in myself as an adult man? How dare you? I'm really excited and so relieved that the country actually turned around and we got the vote. We got marriage equality. I mean, I have to admit, up until I met my partner, I didn't give a shit about it.
It's interesting, though, that when you think of, for a lot of straight people, I think they were like, well, we do believe in equality and we do want equality, but they felt like now that we've given marriage equality, that's enough. But I think that that's the thing, is we should be appreciative of the fact that we've been given that, and that's great. but I think that there's now smaller minorities within our group that are upset that they weren't acknowledged.
Mm.
You know, do you think, you know, what do you think is going to happen next for those people? Like, how do we become more inclusive? It's a big question.
I'm just going to go back to respect.
Mm.
Really, when it all comes down to it, that's just it, isn't it? Is respect.
Mm. Yeah, I think respect is correct. And I definitely think that's the foundation.
Because I have a problem with those words of... I do actually have a problem with the words of acceptance, diversity and inclusion, because it's still, particularly with diversity and inclusion, because it still prioritises a dominant culture.
Oh, it acknowledges that.
I don't know that it acknowledges, but it definitely prioritises.
Well, there really shouldn't be a priority in that.
But that's the kind of the world that we've lived in for how many hundreds, thousands of years, where there's one culture that has dominated for quite some time. Now we have these words like diversity and inclusion. I find those problematic because it is like, I will allow you to come into our space. Mm. Sorry we didn't pay attention to you before.
But it kind of reminds you of what it was like at school. I remember that at school there was a popular group. Mm. And my mum said to me, well, there isn't a popular group. Mm. You know, what makes you think that? That's that person's perception. And if you believe there's a popular group, then there is one.
Yes.
So don't believe that.
Yeah.
So I feel like there's a message in there as well for people going, well, gay men get spoken about a lot. Why don't we speak about bisexual people? Why don't we speak about intersex people, transgender people? But it's a process. We're going to need to get to. We're getting to it all, but we don't want to start sort of singling things out and saying some people have it more than others, because it does do almost what you're saying, and not acknowledges, but it allows you to believe that there is a hierarchy.
But there is.
But how do you change there is. That hierarchy?
Well, I see. At the moment, I don't know. For me, it's not about asking for permission. It's about just claiming space.
So if bisexual people feel like they're not being spoken of, they need to step up and find that space.
Not just that. No. It's not as black and white or cut and dry as that. I think there's a bit of give and take. There's a lot of things that could be done unilaterally and at the same and simultaneously from a lot of different sides. But it does take, I think, a broader awakening from a lot of perspectives.
So it seems like a really strange question to say, but is there anything more that I could be doing, or is there anything more that we could be doing to be more inclusive of the gay Indigenous community?
I suppose in that answer is wherever you see the opportunity, is to just create space. Yeah. Just create space. Don't dominate it with an agenda. Don't try and guard it or guide it or infect it. Just create space. Currently is because including diverse communities usually means being welcomed in, but you must follow. This is how we do it. You know what I mean? Like, it's never an open invitation. It's always an invitation with rules.
And that's what they shouldn't be. It comes down to sort of basically what your mother taught you, or maybe your grandmother taught you, and, you know, to treat others the way that you should be treated. And to, you know, evolve that mentality into the fact that, yeah, the word inclusion is wrong. It's just that you're being a good person.
Yeah.
You're being respectful.
Mm-hmm. It's just, yeah, instead of inclusion looks...
I think that's the answer, actually. I think the answer is, it's not about inclusion, it's about respect.
Exactly.
And you and I have been talking about respect the whole way through, you know, and I think that's where we need to go. Do you have a message for the queer community out there that are listening to this?
I think the message is that your lineage is long. It's very long. Lots of people have fought, died, struggled, and won battles, celebrated and endured, and you are part of that lineage. And it is now your responsibility to carry that, not only for your generation, but for 500 years from now. Imagine who is coming behind you, no matter what age you are now, who is coming behind you, who's going to be here in 500 years. Look what people have done, our ancestors have done for us, our lineage, our queer lineage has done for us for thousands of years. It's a small ask to take that responsibility and make change so that our future in 500 years has something better than what we've just endured over the past two.
You, my friend, are an amazing person who have such a great way with your words, and you've lived your life with an enormous amount of integrity. And I think there's a lot of people out there listening to this right now that will have appreciated your story. And I have to say, thank you so much for taking the time to come in.
Thank you, Ben.
Share your story.
Thanks. For Word is presented and produced by Benjamin Norris from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy. Word for Word is distributed nationally to over 70 radio stations across the community radio network.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.